Hello and welcome to another episode of Radio War Nerd. This is episode 475. I am the co-host, Mark Ames, in Western New York. You're listening to Radio War Nerd. Subscribe at patreon.com/Radio War Nerd. I'm on the line, of course, with the War Nerd, John Dolan, a.k.a. Gary Brecher, still deep down under. How you doing, John?
Fine. Just looking forward to the show.
Yeah, me too. Well, and as John said, there's no reason for any sort of chit-chat beforehand because we want to get straight to our discussion with the gentleman who put out the brilliant, surprising, entertaining, nauseating, sickening, you know, everythinging blowback podcast. And of course, they just put out season 5. On Cambodia. First, let's just welcome to the show the co-hosts, Brendan James and Noah Colwyn. Guys, welcome.
Hello.
Howdy.
Hello.
Thanks for coming on and glad to have you back.
It's great to be back.
Yeah, we had you on when you put out your series on Afghanistan.
Yep.
And Korea.
I think we did Korea as
did.
Well, yeah, season 3.
Yeah, we did season 3.
So this is we're back for a three-peat.
Exactly. And this time around, okay, there's a lot to discuss. It's a great series, first of all. Let's just get that out of the way.
Thank you.
There's a lot in it, as with all of your series. There's so much sort of to chew on, and we'll try and stick with the thread, which is Cambodia. And I guess you probably are getting this question as you guys have just come out with this. But let's start off before we actually talk about Cambodia and the war and the history, and there's just so much. But let's start off with why you guys chose the Cambodian war as your topic. I mean, from my perspective, I think it's really interesting and kind of brilliant because in a way it opens up a lot of possibilities for all kinds of future episodes. As well. I mean, your first one was the Iraq War. And I think when people look back in this century so far, the Iraq War is still like the war with the capital W. Maybe I'm wrong on that. And that was your first war that you guys covered.
No, I think you're right. That's why it was our first.
Yeah. But also what was so interesting about it is because it was so kind of front and center in people's minds, people thought they knew it. And actually so much was forgotten. So there was really a lot to kind of dig up there. But the thing about the Cambodian War, which is a really long story, it's a great entree into the Vietnam War, but it's also a big story on its own that I hadn't thought about before. So anyway, why don't you guys explain why you chose Cambodia?
Well, that's as good a reasoning as any that it gave us a way to talk about a whole galaxy of conflicts, while also, I mean, most notably the war with Vietnam, which was really, when Americans say the Vietnam War, what they really mean is like three wars, maybe even more. You know, we obviously had a secret war. We could have done a season about Laos. And we talk about Laos to the extent that we can without, you know, spinning outward forever into all these other permutations and byproducts of the Vietnam War. But Cambodia, being one of those conflicts, was an interesting case for us because it was trying really hard to be neutral, the country itself, its leaders. And it did a pretty good job of it for a while. But how that came apart then becomes a second war or a third war, if you include Laos. And then when you stay after the Americans withdraw, and indeed even after the communists take Saigon, and the Khmer Rouge take Phnom Penh, that's just the first half of the season. We wanted to stay, see the Khmer Rouge grow and, you know, gestate into obviously one of the most destructive movements in the 20th century, and then get kicked out by our old enemies, the Vietnamese communists, because I don't think a lot of Americans know of whatever generation, I would even say, certainly not people more, you know, in the younger cohort, I don't think they know that Pol Pot was ousted by communists. And that the most, the sort of parody of a communist boogeyman was kicked out by the Vietnamese, and that we punished them for doing it.
Yeah.
And that we withheld food and humanitarian aid from post-Khmer Rouge Cambodia because they were too connected to the Vietnamese. We were still trying to punish and refused to give war reparations from our war with them. And so that's the third Indochina War. Then China invades Vietnam as a punishment. Mm-hmm. So you have, again, this kind of chain reaction that was a way into all these things. We never wanted to do a season straight up just about Vietnam. Mm-hmm. Vietnam's because all the boomers got older and remembered how they marched and thought this is one war we'll never shut the fuck up about. we all know about Vietnam, and I'm not saying it's any less important, but we didn't want to just retread all that. We thought Cambodia was this different angle, I suppose.
Ken Burns already covered it, so that's right?
How are you going to do that again?
Ken Burns, Viet Tan Nguyen, Francis Ford Coppola, it's there.
There are still wonderful details in your coverage, even of the Vietnam War on the American front. Like, I think it's episode 4 of season 5, but I knew about Kent State. Everybody knows about Kent State, you know, the nice college students getting shot by the National Guard. But I had never heard of a bayonet mass stabbing by the, I think it was the National Guard.
Yeah, New Mexico.
New Mexico State.
Yeah, I didn't know about that either.
Yeah, that one was new to me as well. I mean, in reading this season, so, you know, to compliment, one thing I did want to go back to just to compliment what Brendan's saying is that, like, you know, there are, by approaching Cambodia, a number of other kind of storylines, let's say, surface, especially ones that have contemporary resonance. And so before getting to sort of student protest and mass protest against the war, I wanted to point out the China factor specifically in this season. One of the sort of key subplots of the season and, you know, something that is, I would sort of say, a main plot of our current world reality is the American relationship with China and how first a lot of why we, you know, the why for we support the Khmer Rouge in the 1980s is bound up with the fact that we have made an alliance with China that involves a mutual enmity toward at first the Soviet Union, but also Vietnam.
Yeah.
And that's just sort of one, you know, I think like example of something that by focusing on Cambodia and asking the questions of like, well, why was our policy this way? You sort of stumble on like the other big axes of foreign policy at the time.
Yeah, the Sino-Soviet split is a big thread in this season.
Yes, it's great. We'll talk about that too. Yeah.
To your point, John, about the, you know, the student protests, there was in researching the season, I found a really like kind of badly and under-historicized kind of quality of the Vietnam War and the home front. Is not just like, you know, the flower child rebellion and like really the kind of what is the image of middle class anti-war revolt, which there was plenty of, you know, and the moratorium against the war had a very meaningful impact. But there was mass dissension within the ranks. We have a bonus episode that, you know, it's an interview with an airman and his lawyer, a JAG lawyer who were president for a race riot. The airman was, not the lawyer. But then you also have, you know, again, like these protests in places like a historically black college at Jackson State and sort of vary among, you know, again, like the kind of radical edge of these campuses. And, you know, originally out of the GI, then you had, of course, the GI movement in an earlier era that was the first anti-war movement and that was very working class in origin. And so it was just fascinating to sort of see in the course of, you know, researching this season and wanting to tell a unique story about how this time unfolded, that there is this kind of lineage that you can trace of resistance to the war that, you know, we didn't spend tons of time on this season. I don't want to give your listeners the impression that it's a major story, but that, like, you know, even with just a bit of time, you can highlight some details that, like, are pretty, you know, pretty obscure, even with, you know, some of the most well-covered and well-trodden territory of the last 40 years.
Yeah, and you guys talk about this, I think, but I remember when we had Greg Grandin on to talk about Kissinger, and he talked about, we were talking about sort of, you know, these horrific innovations that happened under Kissinger. Well, you guys get into how he turned the National Security Council into this, you know, hot seat of power.
Right.
But that when they started bombing and then invaded Cambodia, I mean, since the GWAT, the war on terror, well, it's kind of taken for granted that you go around assassinating, bombing wherever, you know, wherever the leader says you should. Mm. But when the invasion of Cambodia happened, there was a lot of dissent and not sort of in the establishment class as well. Mm. It was so shocking to them that this sort of thing would happen, the secret invasion and stuff. And you guys have a great, I think this is related, but one of my favorite scenes in your and it's a shorter scene, but I think the National Security Council member's name was William Watts, and he resigns in front of Kissinger, and Kissinger says, you're the weak Eastern establishment. And then he jumps over the chair and tries to beat the shit out of him. Yep. And Kissinger hides
behind his chair.
I was kidding.
Yeah. Yeah. It's kind of like Saul Goodman in Breaking Bad when Walter White wants to beat him up, and he just throws his hands up in the air and goes, "Don't hit me," you know.
it's an amazing scene. I mean, you have to say, Kissinger and Nixon, especially, you know, they're so bad, and they're always so entertaining compared to a lot of other politicians. Yeah.
The psychodrama, you know, between those two and even just within Nixon's own mind, you know, that's another thing that, you know, it's well trodden at this point, but because we had this main focus on the subject of Cambodia, we could play some of the, well, not even the hits, but some of our favorite little flashes of these men and their amazing minds.
And, you know, to our great benefit, they're caught on tape. You know, it's all it's all recorded.
Yeah, and Nixon was proud of that because he thought he was going down with the other Roman emperors in history. And everybody wanted to have his every obscenity and cough. But for me, the revelation about how much free-floating hatred Nixon and Kissinger, who, by the way, was always considered in those days the nice one, how much hatred they could focus on a country that they obviously knew very little about, was revealed in the Blood Telegram, where they were talking about Bangladesh. And it was like instantly they had a whole range of vicious stereotypes to justify the killings in Bangladesh. And I know that people in the U.S. in the 1970s were only, I mean, George Harrison concert. That was about it for Bangladesh. Yeah. But these guys had deep hatred.
Mm-hmm. And for India, too.
Nixon, some of Nixon's most, and there's a lot to choose from, but some of Nixon's most baldly racist statements are about South Asians in particular.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Usually, you know, in his comparative, his comparative politics of racism, He finds something nice to say among the insults to every other group, but he really is on record, thanks to his own brilliant foresight. He's on record saying a lot of incredibly nauseating things about India and the Indian subcontinent.
I also think that you can look at those remarks and you also see what the function of that racism is. Like, it's not just that like Nixon has a racist worldview, which he does and was not particularly uncommon for the time, right? But it's also that, you know, to sort of use the framing that you used, Mark, that like, you know, the racism that he relies on at different points. And it's like, you know, India was giving him problems politically, geopolitically, because it was pretty neutralist. And Pakistan was essentially willing to be an attack dog on behalf of like aligned interests. And, you know, so there's like, it's a really... I do think that at some point, like a really great artist or somebody will listen through a lot of the tapes that they're still not done processing. Some of the tapes that we use in this season, I myself had to fetch from the Miller Center because I read that these tapes, I read a reference to the tape and then had to like find the reel, et cetera. But they're not, you know, like people may assume that like, oh, all this stuff is just searchable in public yet, because most of it is, or maybe a lot of the more well-known stuff is, but we still are learning new stuff, like new lows, new depths that these guys sunk to in their everyday conversation. And a great artist will eventually, you know, weave it into something like more disturbing than Adam Curtis has yet put together.
Yeah, no, that's a great point. I remember years ago when I was living in DC, I knew somebody who was archiving some of this, some of the Nixon tapes, going through them, you know, and sort of writing metadata and so on. Mm. And who said that there is so much more. And we haven't gone through all of it. That's a good point.
To anticipate perhaps a bit, a lot of the hatred for Bangladesh was, and India was in the service of the grand, brilliant China strategy. And that was what I saw among the pseudo-intellectuals who weren't bitterly anti-Nixon, and there weren't quite a lot of them, in Berkeley. It was like, look, Kissinger is doing this brilliant, brilliant thing, opening up China and unrolling the map of the world, because China was a blank spot on the map till then. And anything he does to convince Nixon, because officially Kissinger was the nice guy.
Yep. The intellectual,
the Harvard man. It's fine, you know, whatever they do, it's fine. Just let him do it.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that we, on several beats of the season, we run into the fact that Henry was the, you know, celebrity diplomat, and he was the presentable face of the Nixon administration, and the one that I think fellow elites, although he clearly had a contempt for his own class with the remarks to Watts that we just discussed, they all have self-hatred, of course. I know I do. Especially earlier on, I think Cambodia hurt him on this, is that he was viewed as the guy you could deal with within the Nixon administration.
Yeah.
And Nixon knew that was true of him. And, you know, that's why they got along so well. Everyone could beat up on Nixon, but Kissinger was in his corner and had all of the skills that Nixon lacked with regard to, obviously, diplomacy itself, but also diplomacy with his own domestic fellow politicos and rivals and elites.
And more or less, like, Nixon could trust Kissinger to be a kind of enforcer that, like, you know, just truth be told, like, there's nobody in the government today who can hold a candle to, like, you know, like this isn't to say Kissinger was good, obviously, but, like, the dude had a motor, he had ambition, he had a wide-ranging perspective on what American power could be, and he worked hard to that end. And, you know, that involved a lot of, like, really obviously horrifying decisions. It involved some pretty impressive ones, you know, especially vis-a-vis China or detente with the Soviet Union. But, like, he was just able to be an instrument of Nixon's power, you know, like a hand of the king, in a way that I think is extremely uncommon, you know, like, to at least, I can't think of a comparable figure in the last, like, 30 years in American politics. I can think of a lot of pretenders.
This is an amoral podcast today. Obviously, we're talking,
about this is Machiavelli. This is the Machiavelli cast.
Read Sun Tzu.
Metternichian, because when I first enrolled at Berkeley in the 1970s, this tame academic who, you know, didn't play much part in the history department, but was rolled out to give lectures to incoming first years, did a lecture on Metternich and Kissinger. And it was an example, I think, both of the pretension with which Kissinger bamboozled the Americans, just like his fake German accent that his brother doesn't have, oddly enough. And it was also something more sinister that I've seen a lot of. There are a lot of academics who really love The Sopranos, really love Silence of the Lambs. They really love the idea that inside me,
House of Cards,
is a stone killer.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And Kissinger tapped that.
Yes.
Yeah. And it does have a sort of, again, this is the amoral hour. This does have a beautiful poetry to it, that our most on-record anti-Semitic president of all time, you know, with Kissinger remakes the world, which includes, by the way, an alliance with Israel. And you know, that's a whole different story. But this is part of what made the season so, you know, such a treat for us in particular, as we're clearly letting the listeners know here. We love this shit.
So, but I think when we're talking about, you know, secretaries of state or diplomats of the last 30 years, one thing Kissinger hasn't done or hasn't quite achieved is he doesn't play the axe like Tony Blinken. I mean, he can't do blues rock.
Yeah.
So, you know.
Tony, I mean, it's unmitigated success.
I'll say it. Dignity. It's a little thing called dignity.
When I think of Tony
Blinken. It would behoove our lightweight Secretary of State to, you know, maybe put down the freaking guitar and do your freaking job, man.
Stop rocking it and start doing your job. Right. So let's get to Cambodia and we'll get circle back, I'm sure, to Henry and Dick again. But you start off doing some history, and the history is really important because another running theme in your show is resentment, you know, is there's a lot of resentment running in the show all around, but the resentment of, you know, of a part of Cambodians who for having been once a great empire and now being the little brother to everybody in the region. Mm-hmm. And then intra resentments there. I mean, and then of course, when you have Nixon on the other side of this drama, you know, you complete the whole circle of resentments against elites and so on. But I don't think many people know about, in fact, it's not easy to even find a lot in English about, you know, Kampuchea, Cambodia's, the Cambodian Empire's kind of golden age. But talk a bit about how big and important Cambodia was, and then its fall from glory into sort of, you know, an outpost of the French Empire.
Yeah, it was, it had an amazing run, evidence of which you can still see in Angkor Wat in the northwest of the country, which we went to because this season was the first time we were able to, we came out with our first couple seasons during COVID, so we were unable to travel beforehand to the places we would write. I went to Cuba after our Cuba season. We've both been to Middle East and so forth. But this was a time where we could go ahead of time and do interviews and factor that into the show. And one of the things we did was we saw the wonderful complex of temples in Angkor Wat. They controlled the Mekong Delta, you know, back in the day, which they forever, you know, resented the Vietnamese for moving in on. And they had, according to Elizabeth Becker, in her great book, When the War Was Over, we spoke to Elizabeth for the show as well.
Yeah,
she, you know, makes the point that it was ironically enough, French archaeologists, colonial archaeologists, who discovered how glorious the Khmer Empire had been and how it just is right up there with Greece or Rome in the Western mind of what civilizational excellence looks like. It did begin to, it was wedged between Siam at the time, you know, Thailand, and Vietnam, which was for many years before our modern era split into North and South. You know, and there was Champa and then, you know, Hanoi's kingdom in the north, which was fighting with China. But once you get to the 15th century, after several centuries of supremacy, the Khmer Empire begins to decline and it's getting nibbled at by Thailand and by Vietnam, which had become more or less an independent kingdom finally. And that, you know, you flash forward only a few centuries later, and it's easy pickings for France. They all are, but particularly it's a great fall for Kampuchea.
French rule was, and you know, we've been doing a lot of episodes lately on French colonies in the Sahel and Algeria, basically Northern Africa or Sahel Africa. And damn, every story, you know, I don't know, maybe because we know less about French colonization being Anglos. We know more about, you know, the Anglo worlds, but they're all pretty damn similar. They're incredibly cruel, and you know, as cruel and exploitative as their resources allow them to be. Basically, it's all that different.
And this is, and Vietnam is, you know, contra the Sahel, or contra even, you know, like North Africa, which has, you know, advantages in Mediterranean trade and some mineral advantages, no doubt. Vietnam was very resource rich and very accessible, you know, despite the distance. And in Vietnam, they were able to, because of those facts, develop what really was, you know, sort of the prize of their empire. And Cambodia, even within that system, was, you know, I mean, like Laos, you know, sort of like a subsidiary to Vietnam.
A buffer.
Right.
Exactly. Like more of it. Yeah, exactly. A territorial buffer with Thailand, which was the, you know, like the British colony verging on the non-Chinese British colony, you know, verging in those parts.
And right. And on the, to talk about the exploitation, the nature of the French Empire, you know, you could go into Algeria and all this other stuff as well. But Louis, Napoleon wanted to launch this great imperial project to, of course, catch up to Britain, which, you know, obviously in Asia was supreme by the 19th century. And Cambodia was left relatively untouched, as was Laos, in the structure of its government. But therefore, also, it lost out on what are the, at least, unintentional modernization campaigns that take place in a colony.
Right.
And so the French neglected to build any schools, to,
right.
You know, update any form of agricultural production. And Vietnam would get all of the, it would get worked over with, of course, all the horrible negatives that come along with that. I think in the harshest, remember reading in the worst conditions or worst areas, the rubber plantations that were in Vietnam, a quarter of factory workers would die the job. And they actually had to start looking for workers from other parts of Vietnam that were further away, so that they wouldn't be aware of all the talk of the horrible death dealing industrialization that was happening to their countrymen. So the point being, though, is that during this attempt to reach Asia along with the British, the French had Vietnam as the crown jewel, as we call it, which meant that modern nationalisms, modern political movements in that dialectical way, you know, came up and opposed the imperialists, but not so much in Laos and Cambodia themselves because they were just buffers. They were just real estate.
Right.
And so you get talking about what leads straight to the Khmer Rouge, and their thinking is you get a lot of importing ideas and definitely even people and revolutionary fighters from Vietnam into Cambodia and into Laos. And it was seen by some as a sort of hegemonic fellow colony. And that's going to cause serious problems down the way, this historical, very modern historical rivalry, not stuff that goes back ancient, you know, times and all that, but just the way the French would play the different Indochinese holdings against each other.
Right.
Yeah, there was something else about Cambodia as a kind of backwoods colony, because always a few bright kids, and this is characteristic of French colonies, always a few bright kids get drawn into the orbit of Paris, and they pick up little ideas. And Salazar's circle, unfortunately, got a lot of ideas from Rousseau. And I mean, I did a lot on 18th century essayists, and I ended up with a particular hatred of Rousseau. He's just like somebody who spins out ideas without much thought about the consequences. And he doesn't have a really wide experience He doesn't really understand much, but he knew how to shock, and he does it really well. And he even said, you know, I'd rather be a paradox monger than, I forget the other term, but the idea of someone taking Rousseau's admiration for Sparta, for example, really seriously as an idea for organizing a society is pretty terrifying.
Well, you know, Geneva, if I'm remembering my college courses correctly, you know, Geneva and his vision of democracy was this, as you say, kind of very small and self-disciplined and homogenous place. It could not, he didn't really think that, for example, democracy could function in an area as wide as the United States or even the bigger countries of Europe. And Salazar and his comrades, who did draw a lot from the European, not just the, I mean, Philip Short, no big communist himself, said it really wasn't as much Beijing or Moscow that was in the ideological DNA of the Khmer Rouge as it was some of that, but also the French and European intellectual tradition of the past 200 years. And I think that there was a similar admiration for that Spartan and homogenous, small, self-sufficient political state that they took right with them. Although it should be mentioned, of course, we say it in the show, they did begin fairly moderate compared to where they ended up. And you can read Khieu Samphan, who was always a little bit of a figurehead, but he was a high-ranking member of the party. He talked about a lot of policies that were happening in Thailand, really, just with you know, from a more socialistic vocabulary. But he, you know, he and the others, when they went into the jungles and fought Lon Nol and the American bombs, that all, you know, they shed that skin fairly quickly. And when they were introducing collectivization, they did it more moderately. In like 71 and 72, you could see, you know, this could end right here as far as how intense and how authoritarian it got. But by 73, and of course, by the time they take over in the middle of the 70s, it was a deeply, deeply unrecognizable form of even the worst excesses of communism to that point.
And I think when you said earlier, Mark, that's about like resentment. I think that, you know, like there's no single satisfying cause or explanation. It's obviously like pretty complex, but, you know, in this time, this process by which first they were targeted by the government of the neutralist royal Prince Sihanouk, they were, you know, the Cambodian communists and radicals had no presence whatsoever at Geneva when Cambodia was granted its independence.
Right.
The Vietnamese essentially, you know, brought the Cambodians into their fold and like set up more. Like the first people arrested for being communists in Cambodia were Vietnamese.
Right.
The Vietnamese Communist Party was like, you know, was the dominant part of the Indochinese Communist Party, so to speak.
Yeah, they're always under their shadow. I mean,
and so by the time, you know, and it was Viet Cong fighters doing the bulk of the fighting in Cambodia. And then when that stopped being the case, you know, a lot of Cambodian fighters surely felt that the Vietnamese were leaving them high and dry in the early 70s. And there were, you know, you could just kind of see like this being like a sort of perfect environment for a resentment like that to fester, for it to get really, really, really dangerous, particularly when the conditions get very, very extreme. And they were extreme, you know, from the point basically of American bombing on forward, just because of the sheer, you know, devastation and scale of first the American bombing and then, you know, like the wars of the late 60s and 70s.
But, you know, one thing I feel like I have to stress is that there was a great deal of anticipation, particularly from the American right, of all the horrors that would ensue when the Vietnamese communists took over. And although there were a lot of pretty grim re-education camps, there were not the mass executions that they were honestly looking forward
hoping,
to.
Yes.
Yeah. Absolutely.
because the Vietnamese were a very cosmopolitan elite and extremely disciplined. I mean, they'd been through decades of horror, and they withheld the appetite for vengeance. You mentioned, I think, in one of the podcasts that the Vietnamese military in Cambodia, and it had been there for a long time because the geography is obvious. You want to avoid the narrow strip of Vietnam. You want to bring those weapons in from inland. And then, of course, Lon Nol, rolls the dice or consults the horoscope and goes in and proclaims some millennial thing and commits horrors in Cambodia. Yep. But the Vietnamese communists, I got to say, they had a lot of discipline.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that was what could have been, because you imagine all the history we've just discussed, whether or not there's a Vietnam War happening, Cambodians, if the Vietnamese had not exercised the level of discipline you just talked about, John, and the basic, you know, guerrilla ethic that you can see in other seasons, and certainly not just seasons we've done, but cases all over the world that you guys have talked about, you know, the Cubans, Chinese, and otherwise, and elsewhere. You have to be that disciplined and that ultimately fair and treat the population you're attempting to hide in with dignity, or they'll kick you out as soon as. And that was why Cambodia was a so-called sanctuary on the border, is the Vietnamese did that. If they had been as nasty and domineering as the Khmer Rouge would later claim they were, had always been, they never would have had those sanctuaries in the first place. It would have blown up in their face. Whereas, yes, Lon Nol, fellow Khmer, said, I'll take whatever rice you got, and I'll take your lieutenant over here will take your daughter too. And that was a hated government by the end. And of course that was the one we were backing to the hilt. As you said earlier, they didn't, Nixon and Kissinger and the underlings, they didn't always know a ton about the places, especially the neutral places and the small places. They had a lot of respect for China and a lot of respect for the personalities and leadership and socioeconomic movements happening in China. Whereas in Cambodia, there was a political cartoon from the time that says, where Kissinger and Nixon say, all we know about Lon Nol is his name spelled backwards is Lon Nol. Which is pretty good. It happens to be true, but that was the, to talk more directly about the Cambodian situation in the show. Yeah, that was who we were backing. It was a superstitious government trying to make good with the middle class, but also being really traditionalist and yes, xenophobic. Mm-hmm. The pogroms and mass executions of ethnic Vietnamese in Cambodia under Lon Nol were really a prelude to what would happen under the Khmer Rouge. Yep. And we talked with Ben Kiernan, who was a scholar, one of the probably the preeminent scholar in the English language about the Cambodian genocide, and he said that he finds the French reports from the time to be persuasive that this was a genocidal campaign under Lon Nol. But that was not discussed at the UN tribunal years later, because that was the period in which the Americans were paying the bill and installing and sustaining these guys. So we try to make reference to that as well in the show, is that, you know, this was a very different ideological group of people, but there was a continuity between Lon Nol and the Khmer Rouge as far as the racism goes.
Yeah.
Yeah. There's, I think, I remember exactly which episode this was, but you guys talk about how Khmer Rouge makes that transition from like 71 to about 73, where at first they're trying to follow more Maoist dictums, which is you treat the people that you're hiding with and that you're trying to win over, as you said, with dignity, you try to win them over. And even your enemies, like obviously some enemies have to be killed, but in general, like it's much more successful not to kill them, but to actually win them over. And at first, Khmer Rouge kind of seems to follow that, but they're also still kind of a lot more under 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 Hanoi tutelage. And it's almost like once Hanoi starts backing away, their other side comes out, which they think it's again, I don't know. I don't want to over-psychologize it, but we see this a lot in many of the wars we cover where people who had this sort of great past they could look upon, have a lot of resentment against neighbors built up, even neighbors who help them. It doesn't necessarily feel good that you've been, you know, helped along and you can't do it yourself.
And this narcissism of the small difference too, you know?
Yeah.
Surely. Yeah. And also to, you know, sort of the earlier point we were making about Nixon and Kissinger and how like they relied on racism to sort of suit their needs. Like a lot of the xenophobia and resentment of the Khmer Rouge was ultimately like it got them into the mess that they've put themselves in. Mm-hmm. And it was like what they saw as their way out. You know, they when they were in power and they were, the Khmer Rouge beginning in mid-75, and they begin targeting not just Vietnamese minorities, but eventually Muslim and Chinese ethnic minorities and other, national and ethnic minorities within Cambodia. The Khmer Rouge then they begin this massive reordering of society. And when it does not start to go well, and they start purging everybody, and they start purging people from the eastern zone along the border with Vietnam. And the chief accusation is that these are Vietnamese minds in Khmer bodies.
Yes, that's an amazing line. Yeah.
Then, you know, it becomes
science fiction.
It becomes like this, our anti-Vietnamese sentiment is like a path to like, it's a path leading to our ultimate enemy whom we have to vanquish.
Right.
And that's sort of, you know, and it's delusional, but you know, these people were being delusional as we know, was kind of their stock in trade.
Pol Pot said before the war, and this is, of course, right before the fall of the Khmer Rouge, after they've been in power, where they go to war with Vietnam, a very foolish thing to do. But I suppose it's been convincingly argued to us that it was really their only way out of, as Noah was just saying, the domestic disaster that they had created, that they needed both to mobilize their countrymen and somehow build something again off of war, since they couldn't build it in peacetime. But Pol Pot said, if each Cambodian kills 5 Vietnamese, we'll kill millions of them and we'll defeat them easily. A mind-bogglingly unstrategic thing to base your war off of. But that was, I think, a sincere rallying cry. It's funny to imagine. Actually, it's pretty easy to imagine fancy boys from Paris ending up like that, but or who spent time in Paris. Because Saar, we should mention, I think we say it in the first episode, he was relatively privileged for a Cambodian. Yeah. He had relatives connected to the palace.
Right.
And so he had lived a relatively charmed life, which I guess gave him this, at some point, just this ability to detach from concrete reality and say, no, everything will work out like it did that one time for me and that other time for me. and ultimately the guy died in his own bed. You know, he was under house arrest by his former comrades, but he didn't get executed. He didn't get thrown in a cell.
His final, there were sort of quasi tribunals at which he was forced to, give some account of himself. And the accounts he gave were very strange. Like, nothing so modest, much more Rousseauian and pseudo-intellectual, but basically, I did certain things. They had a good purpose.
I think we cover that in the latter half of the season when he's, because he was as bloodthirsty as ever till the end. He was executing like hikers who were nearby or merchants. And then eventually he said his old defense minister, a guy named Son Sen, he and his wife were on the list. And that's when the also very brutal murderer, Tom Mok, who was his military strongman, he said, all right, I think we're done with the old man now. And they, because I might be next, obviously, that's how that tends to go. And so they put him under house arrest. We have clips from the time of him being interviewed, because at that point, Westerners had decent access to him as an interview. And he would say, just what you're saying, John, like vague disavowals of small mistakes or, but he said in that period, I was trying to protect us from the Vietnamese. Didn't talk about America, didn't talk about, you know, even the Soviets, because you could get, the KGB was a way you could end up in Tulsa Lang or S-21 if you were supposedly KGB and the social imperialists or whatever of the USSR. But at that point, it was just Vietnam, Vietnam, Vietnam. And he dropped all references to Marx and Lenin and Stalin and just talking about the Khmer, you know, race, pro-Khmer supremacy.
Yeah. There's that great scene where that you guys talk about where Pol Pot, I guess it's shortly after they come to power, and he goes to China, to Beijing, and meets with Mao.
That's great.
And yeah, and Mao, it's kind of a Goodfellas-ish scene where Mao's like, De Niro, like, you know, you're going a little too far, a little too far. And
yeah, he's Joe Pesci.
He's Pesci, except instead of Pesci going, no, I don't fucking do that. And he instead is just smiles in that way, in a really kind of scary way.
Chilling.
Smiles and nods his head. Yeah, like, yeah. But
I'm not
thinking,
taking any of this on board.
Exactly,
old man.
Yeah.
What's crazy is that he has like, that's like apparently reportedly the same demeanor that he would have when he ordered people to be executed. Like he'd be talking to them 1 minute and then they would like leave the room and then he would just turn to somebody and say, take care of it.
Yeah. Talk about Sopranos.
I mean, to me, it's very, like that to me is freaky. The kind of the, like, I don't want to, like, I don't think that it's helpful to play it, to play up like a mystique of the Khmer Rouge, because I think that like, they are, you know, they're a historical phenomenon. They're explicable. You know, we can reason what they did. But yeah, there is like a like there are parts where like the affect and there are just lengths that they went to that I'm not really sure many other movements, many other groups have gone to in modern history. You know, from like the forced outfits of the black pajamas and all that. Like it's all. It's all very powerfully unsettling.
Yeah.
Well, to go back to the scene Mark was just describing, and also how that connects to the Sino-Soviet split that is running through the season. You know, Vietnam, for example, were relatively orthodox Marxists. They at times were earlier on in the war. They had more sort of common feeling with China in the Maoist period, and thought maybe that the USSR was a little stuffy and it lost its revolutionary energy and all that. But then you get the Brezhnev period and peaceful coexistence goes out the window as a policy. And the Brezhnev starts supporting a lot more revolutionary movements, a lot more vocally. And the Vietnamese start getting alienated by China and its cultural revolution. And they didn't want any of that cultural revolution spilling over into Vietnam. And they actually would take action to seize literature and prevent the spread of those ideas. The Khmer Rouge, on the other hand, took the Cultural Revolution and its stated, you know, kind of moment of its sort of transitory understanding and said, no, this is forever.
Yes.
And made that the baseline. So the emergency measures of other, at times, very brutal you know, wars or political emergencies of other communist states, that was the baseline for the Khmer Rouge.
Yeah. I also want to put in a bad word for Rousseau, because he's
oh, you've been so nice to him so far.
One of my real hatreds. And he was one of Saar's favorite authors.
Okay,
and,
but Confessions is a pretty darn good book.
I know Confessions is a good book. Yeah. It's a really good book.
Yeah.
And
I'll be honest. Everybody talks about the Usher Super Bowl halftime show. Not my favorite. Not my favorite.
Go ahead, John. I'm sorry. Yeah.
But Rousseau, he started out his career by winning a prize for a counterintuitive essay that history of development has all been bad news for us, and we were better off when we were, as he saw it, farmers. I mean, he didn't. People have taken him up on the ground that he knew we were better off as hunter-gatherers, but he didn't say that. He thought we were better off as some imaginary past as small-time farmers, and everything was nice, even though he didn't technically approve of farming, but he really couldn't imagine a bunch of Neanderthals getting into it with some mastodons. It was something else. And he did this throughout his career, even as he was trying to make it as a playwright and a composer in Paris. And there's something about that double life without any responsibility for the imagining the consequences that it's kind of loathsome about Rousseau. And it is just perfect for somebody like Salazar just landing in Paris and taking from a mix of Mao and Rousseau, not the really sophisticated version of Maoism that's an urbanized elite like the Vietnamese took from it, but a very raw and both sentimental and brutal version.
You know, you read Philip Short's book, obviously, because you quoted a lot. We had Philip Short on the show to talk about...
Yeah, I remember, for Putin.
Yeah, for Putin. And we're big fans of Short. And I remember
his big fans of Putin.
Yeah, big fans of Putin. Yeah, that too. Now, his Mao biography is just, it's one of the greatest, I don't know, nonfiction books I've ever read, I think. And Pol Pot one was as good as, it seemed to me, as good of a biography on Pol Pot as you could possibly write, because it's a pretty unpleasant subject, not just because of the killings, but just everything about him. I don't know. He's obscure. I mean, it's the whole thing about this guy who smiles and doesn't say much, and then millions die, you know?
Well, that's part of what I found. Like, the Putin book is really good because it's like, it's this really rich portrait of somebody who has, you know, a pretty like kind of broad and interesting life experience and a lot of decisions that you can read into that like have his, you know, signature on them and all that. You know, there are parts of his life that are obviously, you know, like a cipher and so on too. But then like Pol Pot by comparison is like really not somebody who, you know, like there's not much information about him, what he did. You have people, you know, like it's like, so I found that like what makes the Short book on Pol Pot so good is how he really zeroes in on the moments and sort of pieces that he does have of the guy, you know, the recollections of people in Paris, the other reconstructions from the interviews with Q Sampan. But then also he's got this like really quite sophisticated and even handed analysis of sort of like Cambodia in the, you know, like of all these different, you know, all the different episodes that we cover. At least that was my view.
Yeah. Like any good biography, it's as much a biography of the nation that the subject came from and led eventually, as it is the human being. And it's a great book to just read about this period in general.
Yeah. So let's talk about, and we'll have to get to Sihanouk, who is a fascinating character.
Absolutely.
I mean, you notice so far, it's kind of interesting. Like when we did our Afghanistan show, that would have been last year, you know, we talked a lot, if not mostly, about Americans. And so far here, we've only been talking about the East Asians in this. I mean, the Cambodians, the Vietnamese, and the Chinese, and I noticed that just in your show as well, which is what I think kind of made it, a little different from your other ones. It's because you have to tell their stories. And they're just, you know, very fascinating. And it's just, anyway, it's very sad and depressing as well. But let's talk about how Cambodia got sucked into the American killing machine. I mean, it's a story, again, where John has talked about this a lot in other wars, other theaters, that there are just a lot of times where it doesn't matter if you don't want to be in a war. You can get sucked into a war.
Well, I've been thinking about I was both re-engaging with this particular episode lately, but I also think I can set it up a bit because I'd be curious to hear how John, like his read of this context, because I think that like that specific question, how did Cambodia get sucked in, has like a specific answer. Which is this, you know, this secret bombing of Cambodia that Nixon decided upon early in his presidency. And that even itself begins with the idea of how one explanation in the waning years of the Johnson administration, particularly as he, you know, announced a bombing moratorium at the, you know, like right up until the 68 election, with negotiations looming that Nixon obviously helped sabotage through Kissinger in
the
one
original respect. October surprise, right?
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. And so, if you look at that environment, like, well, one reason then, like, okay, well, they scuttled the peace talks. The right wingers who are now in control, like, what were the answers? Like, what were the ideas in their pile for what to do about the fact that America was losing this war, but that the war was really fucking unpopular, which it was by this point. And so Nixon's strategy, like the two-pronged strategy that kind of comes to life in the beginning of his administration, is to do Vietnamization, which is to draw down U.S. troops but maintain really substantial aid to South Vietnam and essentially rely on them, but maintain a core U.S. military presence. And at the same time, conduct a secret bombing campaign of alleged South Vietnamese headquarters in Cambodia, which, by the way, were not there. And the idea was that this bombing would target the Ho Chi Minh Trail, the supply line supplying the communist militias, the Viet Cong, that ran through Cambodia. But it did not do that necessarily either. And so it ends up being like this, the process by which Cambodia gets sucked into the war is that Nixon puts it, you know, the operation, the title of the bombing was called Operation Menu. And the first one was breakfast. And then they had different meal names for
that
the successive
missions.
That was
one missions. Of the more astonishing details.
Yeah, so Cambodia was put on the menu, essentially.
Operation
like
Snack.
The war was ongoing. And Nixon decided, well, we've bombed Cambodia in the past. Now we're going to organize it. And Kissinger created a whole secret reporting method to keep it, you know, under
dual
wraps.
Dual accounting.
Right.
Or it's Brendan at this point.
Oh, yeah. Dual accounting, a great euphemism for burning records and having literal, like, bonfires of target lists that shouldn't be known about and are replaced with the congressionally approved sets of lists. Yeah, Cambodia, I think one general summed it up well. I titled the first episode after his quote, which is he said that when the wolves are closing in, you got to throw them a body and let them chew on it. And that was Cambodia. What was happening at the time was Nixon and Kissinger were already had plans to Vietnamize the war, as they called it. Kissinger didn't want to do it. Actually, he thought there would be problems, which there ended up being. But Nixon thought, what I can do is I will have fewer Americans die and therefore take the heat off of, you know, one of the main reasons why there was a popular movement against the war among normies, as we would say now, not necessarily, you know, left wing or ideologically sympathetic people to the plight of Vietnam, but people who just didn't want young Americans to die. He said, fewer Americans will die. But we'll spend a shitload of money and, you know, train this South Vietnamese state into, as we hear in Afghanistan or Iraq, we'll train them up so that they can handle it themselves. And in the meantime, we'll strike at these, you know, little bubbles of safety in across the border, and we'll hit them there to keep them busy, in a sense. And that was just another way of saying Cambodia is expendable and we can buy some time as we Vietnamize South Vietnamese war effort by hitting the same, what we think are the exact same forces in Cambodia. Of course, at the same time, that's what creates the ability for the Khmer Rouge to become a legitimate political authority in the areas liberated from our guy Lon Nol. The Lon Nol coup is what allowed us to invade in 1970 after the secret bombings. But it's all the same project. It's all the project of a kind of bait and switch, which is look at Cambodia for a second while we fix things up and get ready to leave in South Vietnam. And also, of course, try to hit some of these headquarters. And it was politically expedient for them.
One thing I want to say is that, and I feel a kind of guilt for not paying more attention to this early in my life, which is that Vietnam didn't go insane. I mean, that's remarkable, because whatever horrors were visited upon Cambodia, they could probably be matched
absolutely
or exceeded by things that happened to Vietnam. And the control of the Vietnamese emergent elite over decades of horrors is just really remarkable. It seems more remarkable to me than the fact that Cambodia fell into a kind of madness.
Well, John, not to interrupt, but they were actually, I think we put this in the show, the Khmer Rouge, when they were starting to become their own thing, they began to quibble with the Vietnamese, with Le Duan, the head of Vietnam's Communist Party, and said, you know, we've suffered the absolute worst bombings possible. And the Vietnamese were sort of like, bro, we've been doing this for a while. It's not a competition.
Yeah.
As the cones say, first time.
Exactly. And you know, the dark humor in it is that the Vietnamese were all of a sudden looking at each other like, are these guys cool? Because it's not a cool thing to say.
Yeah.
And that was already evidence of their desire to be the most oppressed, their desire to be the most impressive.
The most radical,
the most invincible.
Yeah.
And what Elizabeth Becker told us in our interview with her, and I'm sure in her books as well, she said, the thing is, the Viet Cong did most of the fighting, but the Khmer Rouge, who also did suicidal missions, no doubt, but that couldn't have done it without the Viet Cong at all. They began to feel invincible. They were going up against, even more than Vietnam, a larger country, at that point, an incredibly powerful military regionally. The Khmer Rouge were just these guys who, a couple of years before, were running into the jungles away from Sihanouk, who was not, you know, terribly powerful himself.
Their rush to power was like this, you know, it was like a really crazy sequence of events. Like Phnom Penh falls. A few weeks later, Saigon falls. You know, the whole... It was the Khmer Rouge hit the battlefield meaningfully, kind of precisely at the moment when they, like, you know, they were incredibly overconfident relative to their abilities and vision.
Which is just to say, John, that I didn't mean to interrupt you, but yeah, like that was a conversation in real time about how the Vietnamese were thinking, like, okay, look, we've had a lot of horrors visited on us. What did they do right after that? Is the Khmer Rouge were going, you know, beast mode, was the Vietnamese were saying, we want to normalize relations with the U.S. Please pay us the war reparations you promised. And the U.S. said, fuck you. And Vietnam still tried to negotiate. And it had tons of problems, obviously. The economy was it's one of those things where, it's why I don't know if Ireland ever really wants Northern Ireland back. It's like, when you actually put some pieces of long, you know, historically separated pieces of your country back together, it's really hard to reintegrate everything. And that was a problem for the North and the South. There was progress of things that were incredibly uplifting. And then there was retribution, and there were the re-education camps. And of course, there were the boat people who feared being put in re-education for several months or even several years. But ultimately, they handled themselves in a way that almost defies belief. And we talked on Chapo about this the other day, as just a last remark there, that when we spoke to people, both in Cambodia and Vietnam, you know, we said, you know, we're obviously Americans, we're traveling here, we're talking about America's wars. You know, is there anything you would want Americans to know? And they had no invective whatsoever to share with us. These were older people.
Yeah.
But, and I'm not saying they represent everyone, but we didn't get any interview like that. We didn't get anyone doing some
remarkable,
justifiable, it would have been a very justifiable, you know, lecture to us, a lecture not in the pejorative sense, in a genuinely educational sense, but they didn't. They just said, look, we don't want any more wars. We started to get on with our lives. That's what we want for everyone. We're glad you're visiting. I mean, we know that America right now still is the top dog, does not breed that same level of grace, I would say, you know, 9/11 being a key example.
No, when we fall, we will fall in a very Cambodian way rather than a Vietnamese way. In one sense, the Lon Nol and Khmer Rouge and even to some extent, well, maybe not Sihanouk, but there are just differing interpretations of ways to access an alleged glorious past, you know, mm-hmm. and invoke that, and that will save us. As far as I know, that isn't so much a theme in Vietnamese rhetoric. They're more kind of pragmatic and future-oriented.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that's how you can see them navigating the Sino-Soviet split as well. You know, they eventually went with the Soviets. They were trying to balance it.
Right.
And, you know, a big theme of our season is balancing acts. You know, whether it's Sihanouk in the lead up to his coup, which he did successfully for many years, mm-hmm. Or whether it's the Vietnamese during the Sino-Soviet split, and even peace with America. And that balancing act, and I think, don't want to throw us off course, but you look at Lebanon today getting suckered in by Israel, mm-hmm. and I'm sure Hassan Nasrallah is thinking, do I have a balancing mm-hmm. act in me?
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
Because I can't be a wimp. That's Hezbollah's whole thing, is a resistance block. But mm-hmm. I also don't necessarily want to sign up for the shit that's going on in Gaza.
They'll level every building in Lebanon.
They won't
the
think
IDF
twice.
Will. And that's what, Nasrallah has to deal with. And it's a very tough problem.
Another big thing, I'm glad you brought it up, you know, you talk a lot about the Sino-Soviet split, and you make a great point. I think, again, this is early on, that becomes part of the theme, which is something that isn't talked nearly enough about, which is really nationalism within the communist world.
Yep.
Because, you know, certainly in the CIA or, you know, in the halls of power in America and Britain, probably, the idea always has to be that the communist world is a monolithic world. It must always be a monolithic world. And it's always controlled by Moscow. In fact, there was that former CIA guy who spent a lot of time working in Southeast Asia. I think his name is Ralph McGee, And he talked about how after he got pulled out of Vietnam because he was talking about how things weren't working there and they didn't want to hear it, so he was brought back to Washington to work as an analyst. And the top analyst on communism and the whole communist world, and this is after the border war in 69 between the Soviets and China, mm-hmm. well after that, and after all the, you know, that he strictly enforced the dogma that there is no such thing as a split, that it's pure disinformation to throw us off, but we at the CIA know better. And they are all under the thumb of Moscow, and the whole world is being like controlled by puppeteers. And he just couldn't believe how stupid and crazy they were. But you bring up a great point, which is that before the crack up in Eastern Europe, the national and sort of the reappearance of nationalism there, which was very suppressed in the East Bloc, mm-hmm. in the Warsaw Pact countries. It really starts in Southeast Asia. Well, it starts and in some ways between China and the Soviets. Mm-hmm. But one difference is that the Soviet Union, I mean, what made the Soviet Union and maybe Yugoslavia's communism different from so many other Marxist-inspired movements is that they were kind of anti-nationalist, or at least anti mm-hmm. the dominant ethnic group nationalist. So mm-hmm. the Soviet Union was very explicitly sort of anti-Russian nationalist, even yep. if there were a lot of ways that Russian chauvinism nevertheless, you know,
precisely.
Showed through. But they were that, and the same with Yugoslavia, kind of at least officially. You know,
there's that book, The Affirmative Action Empire.
I've heard of that. I heard it's really good, actually.
Yeah, I haven't finished it, but I've dipped in now and then. And I think, you know, that's obviously a part of the self-image and really existing elements of the Soviet approach to nationalism. Yeah.
Right. And I think there's truth to that too. And so, but with, you know, these national liberation movements like Vietnam, Cambodia even, and others, these were nationalist movements, China as well. These were nationalist movements, like left nationalist movements or Marxist nationalist movements. And you could see why a lot of nationalist movements, national liberation movements would have been Marxist-inspired rather than liberal, let's say, inspired, because liberalism is what colonized them in the
yep.
first place, right?
Yep.
So it makes sense. And yeah, and so you have these real kind of ethnic, which turn into actual ethnic wars mm-hmm. between communist states in Southeast Asia. And it really, I have to say, it confused a lot of people at the time. And then there were these sort of, these really Cold War opportunists, people like Brzezinski, mm-hmm. you know, who could say, no, here is what's really going on mm-hmm. and make it all simple again.
I am fascinated by, and Brzezinski plays a role again in this season. You know, he was obviously the one of the guys who was the architect of the Mujahideen policy. He essentially carried out a very similar policy with the Khmer Rouge.
Yes.
Let's take a local band of fanatics and use them as a blunt instrument to strike at our regional, our regional or global enemy.
Yep.
And in this case, with the Khmer Rouge, it ended up going kind of, you know, a little bit further than it did with the Mujahideen in some respects, not necessarily like in the volume of arms that we sent them. But when the Khmer Rouge were at the United Nations, we fought to keep them there. Even though they'd been thrown out of power at home, because we hated Vietnam and the fact that Vietnam had kicked out the Khmer Rouge and installed their own compliant government in 79, we fought to keep the Khmer Rouge in public, you know, onward. And they were kept, you know, at arm's length for sure, but it was open and official policy of the American government to support a coalition of opposition to the Vietnamese that included the Khmer Rouge. And although the U.S. denied that there was, quote unquote, leakage of aid and materiel and arms and stuff to the Khmer Rouge, it's really clear. And Peter Jennings, among others, reported and showed that actually, no, it just went to straight up to the Khmer Rouge. And this was all, of course, mediated by our new friend of the period, China.
It's such an old or a template we see over and over again. I mean, thinking about Syria, you know, we officially back the so-called moderates, but somehow a lot of those weapons leaked to Al-Qaeda. And because Al-Qaeda were the craziest and the only ones who actually could fight fairly well against the Syrian forces and Hezbollah. And, you know, and then our Gulf allies, of course, they funded it. Basically, it turned out the most extreme groups in those situations are the ones that can be your blunt instrument, whether it was Islamic State or Al-Qaeda, Al-Nusra, HTS as it is today. And, you know, and then in Ukraine, there's been all kinds of leakage to the Azov movement, the neo-Nazi movement, which is, you know, thanks to the invasion, you know, 100 times bigger now than it ever was. But also was delisted as a radical organization by the State Department. They said, "Oh, they're fine now," and with zero evidence that they've in any way denazified. But they fight better than most other units. They're more willing to kill for sure.
And in this case, you know, they were the experienced party. They had just left power. You know, they were. You know, it's, you know, if it's not vanilla, it's chocolate. Like generally speaking, like they were the other. They were the alternative to Vietnamese-supported power. So, I mean, I think one of the other, what's especially kind of jarring, I think, is how, while this was like ultimately like the idea here, you know, like the impetus here, especially as Brzezinski set it up, was to, you know, develop something to counter like a Moscow-directed operation. Because even, and actually, especially at this late date, for the Soviet Union anyway, in the 1980s, Washington still believed that like enormous, you know, like Vietnam, the Hanoi policy was directed from Moscow.
Yep.
And so thus, you know, fighting Vietnam in Cambodia was by their logic, like a way of fighting Moscow. Yep. But even by that logic, like this was an exceptionally pointless and painful struggle, because all it ended up doing, as like Vietnam in the latter half of the 80s underwent its own market reforms and stopped occupying Cambodia, you know, it just arrested the development of the country like really, really badly. It became, you know, very corrupt, very poor, even though the Khmer Rouge never returned to power. It was a low-level insurgency well into the 90s. And I mean, in general, I think it's a kind of it's an especially I'm not really interested in like weighing the relative atrocities of of U.S. foreign policy, but I do think that in this case, it's pretty astonishing just how long the tragedy was of American policy, but like how, you know, chronologically, how little of it, like, you know, the last like 25 years of it from the 80s onward was just not really known.
No. Well, I think we've talked about that in a weird way through popular culture. Like, I think a lot of young people imagine that Southeast Asia was always current in popular culture in America. That isn't exactly true. There was a massive wave of willed forgetting.
Yes.
And mm-hmm. the first Vietnam movie that made any impression was The Deer Hunter, and it was a maudlin whitewash. I mean, kind of crazy, in fact.
Yeah.
And it appeared in 1978, like years after the evacuation of Saigon. Yeah. So the main thing that I remember for most people is good riddance to it.
Yes.
And I hope something bad happens to them.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah.
But it is amazing that it really is a feat of, I don't know, mind control propaganda that the Khmer Rouge was managed to be instrumentalized by and armed, you know, let's be honest, and armed by the U.S. Still around after 78, you know, by the thanks to the U.S. and its allies and its efforts. But at the same time, the Khmer Rouge is also held up as a prime example of the evils of communism.
Yeah.
Yep. You know, but the reason we sanctioned Vietnam for ending the genocide. I think we never forgave Vietnam for being the communist country that ended a communist genocide, on top of not forgiving them for defeating us, obviously, in war. But that was like salt in the wound. Like, you can't do that. You can't be the good guy.
Well, I mean, and they held tribunals even that were, you know, I interviewed now a retired Ohio State law professor who was present, and a guy named John Quigley. And I read, you know, around 2002, he put together like a pretty impressive compendium of documents from the tribunal. And like, look, it was not the most sophisticated or even-handed legal proceeding, but like there was like, you know, just there was like a bare minimum accountability process and all of that. And the reaction in the West, you know, there was some coverage of it, but it was just downright, you know, dismissal,
totally.
Condescension.
Yeah.
You know, and this is like preceding the, you know, the movie, The Killing Fields by, you know, which is celebrated in a very, very good mm-hmm. movie, by the way, but like, mm-hmm. which was, and made by British people who do not share the sins of the Americans in this way. But like, you know, was just totally like, you know, this was totally, what Vietnam did was totally derided and ignored and left out of it.
Propaganda, communist propaganda.
Yeah.
It's amazing. And that's one of the things, I mean, you know, and obviously your series, your show in general, it's blowback, but what kind of is remarkable to me, considering the sins of the Cambodian part of the, we're not even talk about the Vietnam War itself, but really just the kind of the gratuitous, nasty sins of the Cambodian War, the invasion, the support for Pol Pot, that there's so little blowback for that, actually, in terms of basically that, in terms of accountability, I guess is what I mean, in terms of any kind of accountability or memory of it. I mean, thank God you guys did a whole series on it, so hopefully it'll be more widely known. But in general, it's only sort of known as an excess of the bad Vietnam War.
There was a congressman who was interviewed by Peter Jennings who, you know, described support for the Khmer Rouge as the last battle of the Vietnam War. And he called the U.S. policy a policy of hatred, a hatred of Vietnam, you know, because they won the Vietnam War. They're Vietnam now.
Yeah. I think on that really miserable note, I think we can wrap this up. I mean, there's a lot to talk about. I can't recommend
this
enough.
There's tons to talk about. We could talk for hours.
It's like we barely scratched the surface because there's so much in there. And we haven't even really talked about Sihanouk, who's a wild character. We could go on for an hour just on, I know.
Yeah, I had never heard the bits of interview with him. He's like, he's like trying to be calm here, like, well, you're all crazy, but.
Yeah, amazing. And you know, Brzezinski, you know, the God, that guy, he just says, he needs to be known more. He pops up everywhere malevolent. There's Brzezinski.
The idea of hell keeps popping up.
Yeah, I know.
He's, listen, I think that he's done the world a favor, both with his obvious astute, peace-minded foreign policy and his wonderful daughter.
Anyway, thank you again so much. Brendan James, Noah Colwin, and everybody.
Subscribe
to Blowback. You get all five seasons, right? You get a whole bunch of bonus interviews as well. Why don't you?
Yeah, I'll lay it out. The pitch is this: for $25, which you can get it, which you pay at Blowback.show, you get 20 episodes of season 5, which you can binge now. One is the free episode that's out, but then the rest of it is you can binge the main story episodes, which will not be coming out for a few months. And when they do, they come out week by week. You get them all. And you also get 10 bonus interviews or 10 bonus episodes, which are paywalled forever. And those 10 episodes include interviews with Seymour Hersh, like we had last season, with the journalist Elizabeth Becker. I do a couple kind of one-off episodes, you know, talking one about like drug trafficking and another about, I guess, art looting in Cambodia. And I interviewed an airman who witnessed a race riot, as I mentioned earlier.
Right.
But that's some of the, you know, that's exclusive stuff that you only get if you go to blowback.show and sign up.
I got to say, the Elizabeth Becker clips that you guys run in your regular series, there's some amazing stuff there. She's really good. And
she's
that
great
story about how the guy came in to kill her and she just, without thinking, ran into the bathroom and hid in the bathtub. Like, God, what a scary story, you know? Yeah. That was an amazing story, yeah.
Yeah, that was pretty freaky.
Yeah.
So thanks for having us on.
Thank you guys for coming on. Really appreciate it. And looking forward to season 6 as well.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, that wraps up our interview with the Blowback gentlemen. Thanks again to Brendan and Noah for joining us. And thanks again, everybody, for subscribing and for supporting the show. Talk to you again soon.
Thanks, Bye. Everybody. Bye.